This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Communist China turns 70. Even as China showed off its military might in an elaborate parade marking the country's 70th anniversary under Communist Party rule, violent clashes erupted between pro-democracy demonstrators and security forces in Hong Kong in a direct challenge to the mainland's tightening grip on the autonomous city. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The People's Republic of China has surpassed the Soviet Union in terms of its longevity as a communist power. And that matters to President Xi Jinping, who sees himself as a disciple of Mao Zedong, according to regional experts. The columns of tanks and intercontinental ballistic missiles that rumbled through the streets of Beijing on October 1 illustrated the country's strength and modernization. However, the portrayal of China as an increasingly confident nation on the world stage has butted up against a confluence of some of the most severe challenges that Mr. Xi has faced since his ascension 7 years ago. Compounding months of protests in Hong Kong that have spilled at times into open defiance of Beijing's rule, China's leaders are also contending with faltering economic growth, due in part to protracted trade tensions with the United States and continuing international scrutiny over the treatment of Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. Well, with us to discuss the significance of the 70th anniversary of the People's Republic of China are two distinguished regional analysts. Michael Swain is a senior fellow in the Asian program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Walter Lohmann, he's the director of the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center and is a close observer of China policy. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Well, Michael Swain, let me begin with you. What is the significance of this day for the Communist Party and Xi Jinping's rule in particular? All this display of weaponry obviously meant to demonstrate China's military strength. What's the message to the world?
Well, I think the message to the world you really alluded to in your opening comments, it's to show the world and to show the Chinese people that China has really made it. It has all the accoutrements of a major power, that it has succeeded in 70 years in transforming the country and building its prestige, its influence, both in military and in non-military areas. And as you said, for 70 years, longer than the Soviet Union existed. So the idea is that we're strong, we're successful, and Chinese can be proud in the accomplishments of the People's Republic of China.
How do you read it, Walter?
I agree with that. I guess what struck me most about it was the contrast between the celebrations there and actually the reaction to it in Washington, congressional reaction and others, activists that had something to say about the celebration of the Communist Party itself. And it just makes one realize that as long as really the Communist Party governs China, we're never going to have a really normal relationship with China. And I think that's just a reality of the environment, different values. Doesn't mean that we're headed for conflict with Chinese, doesn't mean that we can't manage the problems with them. But it's just such a visceral reaction that Americans have, even just to seeing the flag of the PRC. That's always going to be a problem for us, whatever kind of reforms are made in China. The best we can do, I think, is manage through our problems and differences we have.
Turning back to you, Michael Swain, let's look at this so-called split screen that we saw. We had this magnificent celebration in Beijing, but we had Hong Kong protests. To what extent did these Hong Kong protests spoil, in a sense, the show for Mr. Xi?
To a certain degree, certainly it tarnishes the kind of image that Xi Jinping and the Chinese leadership want to project about China, that the one country, two systems formula, as they call it, is a suitable and a well-supported formula from governing a place like Hong Kong, with the implications, of course, that that formula could also govern Taiwan if Taiwan were to reunify with the mainland. But given the prolonged nature of the protests going on and their violent nature in some respects now, increasingly so it seems, sure, it can't help but damage the image of the PRC. And that's going to continue, I think, for some time.
Walter Lohmann, your take on these Hong Kong protests and to what extent they marred this important milestone for Xi Jinping?
I think they marred the image he was trying to portray, at least internationally. I think in the mainland, I don't think it really has much impact. I don't think they're looking at the split screens. In fact, they're looking at really just the parades and the celebration of the CCP. But I find the most interesting part of this, the evaluation that's going on in U.S. policy circles, when we're trying to look at what the Chinese might do, what Beijing might do in response, the CCP is an eminently rational decision-making body with all kinds of layers and ways to go about this. They're going to reach a rational decision on what to do. Now, it might be the wrong decision. I'm not saying it will be the right decision, but it won't be determined because some guy threw the flag into Victoria Harbor, or somebody standing on the flag, or somebody spray painted the national seal in front of the LegCo building. It's not going to be that sort of reaction. They're going to look at the facts and the developments there and look at their prospects for success, which I would say is pretty low. That is, prospects of success for Beijing to do something, to intervene somehow. So I think it's important to keep in perspective how China really calculates these kind of decisions.
Let's move back to how far China has come since 1949, Michael Swain, the decades, the Cultural Revolution, Deng Xiaoping, Jiang Zemin, Hu Jintao, now we have Xi Jinping, and I'm sure I missed a couple of leaders. How would you characterize the evolution?
It depends a lot on the kind of criteria you apply in trying to assess the PRC over that long period of time, because it's been a very, very mixed bag. It's seen hugely tumultuous, violent upheavals resulting in the death of millions of people. It's also seen enormous progress for the livelihood of the average Chinese citizen in terms of illiteracy rates, in terms of poverty rates, in terms of health care. It's all been positive from that point of view. And in terms of the mobility of the Chinese people to be able to get around the country, to be able to travel outside the country. I mean, I first went to China in the early 1980s. And as many Sinologists will say, I mean, the transformation, when you look at the country today, and you look at it then, it's just absolutely enormous. Now, that has come alongside a lot of really problematic aspects. Sure, the level of control and repression and political monolithic control from the center has been very high. It's varied over time, but it's been quite high over the years. And so you've had that kind of a negative implication from the point of view of Western democracies in particular, and the idea that the Chinese regime is in some sense cruel and despotic, which is what you're hearing now from the Congress as they look at the 70 years of the PRC's history. I tend to believe that even though many Chinese people, and particularly in the cities, are not happy with aspects of PRC rule, they certainly dislike the levels of corruption. They certainly dislike some of the heavy-handedness in local control. At the same time, there is still a sense of pride in the accomplishments that China has achieved in the past 70 years, especially when you think about what China was like even before 1949, when the country was divided and racked by war and totally disunified. You didn't know what the future would be. So the Chinese regime overcame that through a lot of actions, both good and bad, and put it ultimately on a course for much greater progress. Now, a lot of that progress has happened since the beginning of the reform period, which is the late 1970s, early 1980s, when Deng Xiaoping's policies of reform and opening up really began to take hold in China. And you began to see a real emphasis on economic growth and development and a greater degree of relative freedom to what's happened in the past. And I think people still need to recognize that as they look at China today. The Xi Jinping government has responded to the upheavals, the instabilities created by rapid reform, and what they see as the efforts of the West to try in some respects to undermine China by emphasizing and excessively emphasizing, in my view, party control and ideology, more so than Xi's immediate predecessors had done. And he's really a kind of Leninist in that respect. He's looking at these ways to try to maintain stability and continue growth in China. He wants to purify the leadership and the party, and he wants to make it more honest and therefore more supportable by the people. And yet at the same time, he wants to continue to have that level of rapid growth despite increased party controls. And that's a really tough balancing act for Xi Jinping.
Well, that's a good point. And turning to you, Walter Lohmann, to discuss not just the progress but the many shortcomings, because much of the economic progress has come at great costs, perhaps not for those in the rural areas, but particularly for the urban population. And Michael Swain talked about that rural-urban divide, because the repression, whether through censorship of information and other surveillance methods, which we're seeing grow and grow under Xi Jinping, I wonder how long that can continue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, the Chinese have, as a part of their founding myth of the PRC and CCP, is this 100 years of humiliation that they suffered. And I think it becomes a little bit rote after a while, the way we talk about it, but it was absolutely extraordinary period of disunity and destruction and death. 100 years of humiliation, beginning basically with the Opium War through the founding of the PRC in 1949. So there was almost sort of a collective psychosis going on in the early years of the PRC. And the people, in order to deal with that fear of a similar sort of domestic breakdown, civil breakdown again, put up with a lot. But now you've had successive generations. We're four generations, five generations removed. The people who are entering the workforce, the people who are looking for jobs in American companies or European companies or Japanese or Singaporean and trying to make their way in the world, in Beijing, trying to travel abroad. I don't think it has the same weight that it had for previous generations. And those people feel the restrictions much more closely. So they are worried about the surveillance and many other issues. There's such a long string of issues. But I think younger generations are less prepared to accept it than previous may have been.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. Our guests are Michael Swain. He's senior fellow in the Asian program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Walter Lohmann, from whom you just heard. He's director of the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center. We're discussing the significance of the 70th anniversary of the People's Republic of China, progress and challenges facing President Xi Jinping. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a big shout out to a loyal Encounter listener from Eastern China, Zeng Weimin. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Michael Swain, I just have a quick question for you. So we have this sort of dichotomy, you know, the market economy and progress made, and yet censorship continues to be such a prominent feature of the communist country. China has been able to grow as a strong market, a capitalist economy, at least a hybrid one, but maintaining this very airtight grip politically. Now, the hope was somehow that trade would encourage an open society. Has that hope died?
No, I don't think that hope has entirely died. You first have to say, what do you mean by an open society? And there, I think the idea that, and this has now become a common refrain, that U.S. policy was based on the idea that engagement would create a kind of liberal democracy in China was a myth, to use one of Walter's words. You know, when you look at the history of U.S.-China relations, you look at U.S. policy towards China, U.S. officials did not base their policies of engaging with a gigantic country like China that was opening up on the idea that the only measure of success was China becoming a democracy. That is very unlikely to happen anytime soon. But you nonetheless have seen an enormous amount of progress, as I've said before, in engaging with the Chinese. The question for the Chinese is, how do you balance that progress and maintain that level of progress while maintaining levels of control that the Communist Party feels absolutely it must sustain, both for its own survival and for what it regards as the unity and stability of the Chinese government? Now, I think they've basically gotten the majority of Chinese people to accept the compromises that Walter referred to on their own individual freedoms because they see the Chinese government still as providing the most essential elements of what they need to have in order to progress. Higher standards of living, higher levels of personal security, ability to move around the country and to go overseas, and all of what that means. Alleviation of poverty, relatively better health care, way better education than they had, you know, decades ago, and the ability to send their children to education overseas, which they do in large numbers, among the urban elite at least. And I think they take that trade-off, and they see it by and large, despite the discontent that does exist over certain aspects of PRC rule and Xi Jinping's rule in particular. And there is some level of discontent, particularly among intellectuals, about what is happening in China today. But nonetheless, I think many Chinese look at the situation on balance, as long as the economy continues to produce for China and for themselves and remain relatively stable and remain nationalistic in the sense of proud with Chinese influence in the world, they're willing to give the PRC a lot of slack.
Anything to add or subtract to that, Walter?
No, I agree with that. I think the unwritten agreement between Chinese people, again, particularly younger generations, the generations that have emerged since reform and the CCP, is that you keep delivering for me and I won't cause any problem. I think they're proud to be Chinese. I think their pride in the CCP is just that it has brought China to where it is today. But I don't think they have any residual pride in the Communist Party itself. So the day that the CCP stops delivering is the time the deal is off.
All right. Well, back to you, Michael Swain. What do you see as the major sources of strategic tension between China and the West in the years to come?
I think that there are two different issues that really could become very, very problematic in the strategic sense. The first is, if the United States and China keep going on the course in which they're going, that the strongest, most vibrant economies in the world will become increasingly divorced from each other, that you will get this so-called decoupling, which I don't think will ever occur in a complete way, but could produce enormous amounts of blowback and collateral damage, not just for the United States and China, but for the entire global economy. That's not to say that there are certain issues that the United States has with China in the economic area that need to be addressed and that require, in some cases, what you might call a tougher U.S. policy in some respects, if you can really address what those levers would be in influencing China. And I don't think the current administration is doing that very effectively. But in any event, that kind of decoupling, I think, would be very, very detrimental for both the United States and China, and I just don't think it's a good option. But there's a real danger of that. Second is what's going on in the Western Pacific. Today, China's position in the Western Pacific, both economically and militarily, is vastly, vastly greater than it ever was in the past since 1949. China has acquired military capabilities that really challenge what had been a long-standing 70-year American predominance in the maritime reaches of the Western Pacific. The Chinese have basically eroded much of that predominance. So we're evolving towards a rough balance of power in the Western Pacific. Americans used to talk about a balance of power. What they really meant was American predominance, that America's predominance would retain and sustain stability and growth in the region, allow other countries to focus on growth, not have to deal with hard security issues. That dynamic is changing. Why? As China becomes stronger militarily and economically, its willingness to present its interests and push its interests, if you will, to in some way take risks could increase. So the likelihood or the possibility of miscalculation over issues like Taiwan, the South China Sea, the East China Sea, and other issues arguably increases because they think they have more leverage. By the same token, the United States, because in a relative sense, it perceives that its freedom of action is eroding, and other countries see its freedom of action as eroding, it's inclined to overreact to what the Chinese might do by way of miscalculation, both in order to push back against the Chinese and deter them, and in order to disabuse both the Chinese and others that the U.S. capacity has in any way diminished. So that kind of unstable balance that I think we're getting, and I don't think the United States is going to resolve it by staying well ahead of China militarily in the Western Pacific. I do not think that that is a very feasible option for the United States. We have to think about how to make an unstable balance more stable. And that is, I think, a major strategic challenge in the Western Pacific.
So, Walter Lohmann, let me get you to answer the same question. Sources of strategic tension between China and the West in the years to come.
Well, there's a whole range of interests that the United States have that conflict directly with the Chinese. Freedom of navigation, freedom of the seas is something that actually is embedded in American foreign policy for 200 years. The relationship we have with Taiwan, our interest in preserving Taiwan's autonomy and its way of life and its governing system. There are some others too. Those are two of the most severe. I agree that there's the prospect that differences over those could provoke some miscalculation, some escalation. And that's why we have to be so clear, I think, with the Chinese about our interests there and where we have them elsewhere. The Chinese lay out their interests very clearly to us, and they're very much sustained over time. If I could come back to a previous thing that you were discussing about this sort of false promise of prosperity delivering on democratic reform, the kernel of truth in it that is still yet to be tested is that it's actually economic freedom and liberalization that leads to changes on the political side. And it's not so much just prosperity in and of itself. If you can buy a Coca-Cola and you can buy a pair of jeans, it doesn't mean anything about the way that you might want to be governed or your sensitivities on the political side. But if you are controlling more of your everyday life, which the Chinese are, if the companies in the country are allowed to compete on a sort of fair basis without excessive government interference or preference for one sector or another or the like, I think that does generate more on the political side because you're building constituencies that care about this stuff. And that's what ended in China about 10 years ago, very much slowed. Economic reform came to a halt sometime in the Hu Jintao years and has retrenched since. And now Xi Jinping himself has mixed ideas about where this should go. He very much favors big state-owned companies, largely because of their capacity to employ a lot of people. And he has, at the same time, loosened the reins here and there on international investment. So China still hasn't made up its mind on that. And I think that's what you could attribute the lack of any effect on political reform in the last 10 years or so.
I'm very fascinated about what you were just saying, Walter Lohmann, because I do believe that with a proper type of economic reforms, that more political opening would be inevitable. Nonetheless, quickly back to you, Michael Swain, with regard to this trade dispute between the United States and China, do you think that the scenario would be different if the U.S. had not withdrawn, for example, from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was meant basically to constrain China? Of course, Mr. Trump withdrew the United States and then came up with a tariff type of a policy to both punish China for its violation of fair trade, but also to try to get it to make reforms. But we're not seeing much progress in that regard. We're seeing actually U.S. consumer and farmers being hurt.
Mm-hmm. I think if you had a U.S. administration that did not withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it would mean that the U.S. administration believed that multilateral economic agreements were valuable and that there was some real utility for the United States in pursuing those kinds of agreements and that they could eventually put pressure on China to itself liberalize in some respects. So it really would assume a whole set of philosophical beliefs about international trade that, frankly, this current administration and President Trump simply don't hold. I mean, they believe that international economics is essentially a series of bilateral deals, which you make by trying to leverage, coerce the other side into agreeing to your demands by leveling these tariffs. If you look at the U.S.-China economic relationship, sure, there are lots of problems with it in various areas. But in my view, on balance, net-net, it's been positive. It has produced a lot of jobs in the United States. It has produced a lot of low-cost consumer products for the United States. It has led to investment in different technology areas for startups. Now we have this cartoonish notion that all the Chinese economy is about is mercantilism and predatory economics to prey on other countries. And I think that that is just a fundamental distortion of the greater, much greater complexity that we have with the China relationship. I think what we need is a reformed WTO. We need to have a renewal of the bilateral investment treaty negotiations, which had progressed quite significantly under Obama. And we need to have our allies in particular with us cooperating on dealing with China and confronting China in some respects on some of its bad practices. The U.S. administration right now is not doing that.
Well, you get the last word, Walter Lohmann.
The tariffs are not the right instrument to do that. I mean, Americans pay those tariffs. The tariffs that Trump has imposed on the Chinese affect Americans and the American economy more and to the detriment of us more than they affect the Chinese. So the American strength is actually in our ability to set international rules, leverage our market to change rules, to liberalize rules, to bring others into it. We're not going to be able to compete with the Chinese one-on-one. Decoupling, or call it whatever you want, the rest of the world's not going to stop for this. The Europeans are still going to be investing in China. The Germans are still going to be invested. The Japanese are going to be. The Taiwanese, who have more at stake than anybody, are still going to be investing in China. So decoupling isn't really a decoupling from China, the U.S. and China. It's decoupling the United States from the rest of the world. And that's not going to work for us economically or strategically.
Well, I'm afraid on that note, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Michael Swain, Senior Fellow with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Walter Lohmann, Director of the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center. Gentlemen, thanks so much for a terrific conversation on the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guests. Our engineer was Chung Wong. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.